His aloof and lofty style did not go down well with the rank and file of the Liberal Party. He had long been a Liberal MP, yet he believed that foreign policy was too important to be subjected to the agitations of parliamentary debate. He was a foreign secretary who knew little of the world outside Britain, had never shown much interest in travelling, spoke no foreign languages, and felt ill at ease in the company of foreigners. He was a Liberal politician whose vision of policy was opposed by most Liberals and supported by most Conservatives. He became the most powerful member of the faction known as the Liberal Imperialists, yet he appears to have cared little for the British Empire. His views on foreign policy and national security were tightly focused on the European continent. There was a curious dissonance between Grey's persona, private and public, and his modus operandi in politics. As a young man, he had shown little sign of intellectual curiosity, political ambition, or drive. He idled away his years at Balliol College, Oxford, where he spent most of his time becoming varsity champion in real tennis, before graduating with a third in jurisprudence, a subject he had chosen because it was reputed to be easy. His first unpaid political post was fixed up through Whig family connections. As an adult, Grey always cultivated the image of a man for whom politics was a wearisome duty rather than a vocation. When Parliament was dissolved in 1895, following a Liberal defeat in a key vote, Grey, who was then serving as an MP and Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, professed to feel no regrets. "I shall never be in office again, and the days of my stay in the House of Commons are probably numbered. We," he and his wife Dorothy, "are both very relieved." Grey was a passionate naturalist, birdwatcher, and fisherman. By the turn of the century, he was already well known as the author of a justly celebrated essay on fly fishing. Even as Foreign Secretary, he was apt to leave his desk at the earliest opportunity for country jaunts, and disliked being recalled to London any sooner than was absolutely necessary. Some of those who worked with Grey, such as the diplomat Cecil Spring Rice, felt that the country excursions were getting out of hand, and that the Foreign Secretary would be well advised to spare some time from his ducks to learn French. Colleagues found it difficult to discern political motivation in Grey. He struck them as devoid of personal ambition, aloof and unapproachable. And yet, Grey did develop a deep appetite for power and a readiness to deploy conspiratorial methods in order to obtain and hold on to it. His accession to the post of Foreign Secretary was the fruit of careful planning with his trusted friends and fellow Liberal imperialists, Herbert Asquith and R.B. Haldane. In the Relugus Compact, a plot hatched at Grey's fishing lodge in the Scottish hamlet of that name, the three men agreed to push aside the Liberal leader, Sir Henry Campbell Bannerman, and establish themselves in key cabinet posts. Secretiveness and a preference for discreet, behind-the-scenes dealing remained a hallmark of his style as Foreign Secretary. The posture of gentlemanly diffidence belied an intuitive feel for the methods and tactics of adversarial politics. Grey quickly secured unchallenged control over the policy-making process, ensuring that British policy focused primarily on the German threat. It would be going too far, of course, to view this reorientation of British policy as a function solely of Edward Grey's power. Grey was not the puppet master. The men of the new policy, Bertie, Harding, Nicholson, Mallet, Tyrrell, and so on, were not manipulated or controlled by him, but worked alongside him as the members of a loose coalition driven by shared sentiments. Indeed, Grey was quite dependent on some of these collaborators. Many of his decisions and memoranda, for example, were modelled closely on reports from Harding. The ascendancy of the Grey group was eased by recent structural reforms to the Foreign Office, whose object had not been to reinforce the authority of the Foreign Secretary, but rather to parcel influence out more widely across a range of senior officials. Nevertheless, the energy and vigilance with which Grey maintained his ascendancy are impressive. It helped, of course, that he enjoyed the firm support of his former co-conspirator Herbert Asquith, Prime Minister from 1908 until 1916. The backing of a large part of the Conservative bloc in the House of Commons was another important asset, and Grey proved adept at maintaining his cross-party appeal. But Grey's plenitude of power and consistency of vision did not entirely protect British policymaking from the agitations characteristic of the European executives. The anti-German position adopted by the Grey Group did not enjoy wide support outside the Foreign Office. It was not even backed by the majority of the British cabinet. The Liberal government and the Liberal movement more generally were polarized by the tension between liberal imperialist and radical elements. Many of the leading radicals, and they included some of the most venerable figures in the party, deplored the Foreign Secretary's policy of alignment with Russia. They accused Grey and his associates of adopting a pose towards Germany that was unnecessarily provocative. They doubted whether the advantages of appeasing Russia outweighed the potential benefits of friendship with the German Empire. They worried whether the creation of a triple entente might not pressure Germany into adopting an ever more aggressive stance, and they pressed for détente with Berlin. A further problem was the complexion of British public opinion, especially within the cultural and political elite, which, despite intermittent Anglo-German press wars, was drifting into a more pro-German mood during the last few years before the outbreak of war. Antagonism to Germany coexisted across the British elites, with multi-layered cultural ties and a deep admiration of the country's cultural, economic, and scientific achievements. Grey met these challenges by shielding the policy-making process from the scrutiny of unfriendly eyes. Documents emanating from his desk were often marked "for limited circulation only." A typical annotation from his private secretary reads, "Sir E. Grey thinks this circulation sufficient." Consultations on important policy decisions, notably regarding the deepening commitment to France, were confined to trusted contacts within the administration. Cabinet was not informed, for example, of the discussions between France and Britain in December 1905 and May 1906, in which military representatives of both countries agreed in principle the form that a British military intervention in support of France would take in the event of war. This mode of proceeding suited Grey's elitist understanding of politics and his avowed view of the Entente, which was that it should be cultivated in a loyal and generous spirit, ensuring that any pitfalls arising would strengthen rather than weaken the agreement, and that the gradual advance into a deepening commitment should always be insulated from party controversy. In other words, Grey ran a double-track policy. In public, he repeatedly denied that Britain was under any obligation to come to France's aid. London's hands remained absolutely free. Pressed by hostile colleagues, he could always say that the interlinked mobilization scenarios of the military were mere contingency plans. By means of these complex manoeuvres, Grey was able to impart a remarkable inner consistency to the management of British foreign policy. Yet it is easy to see how this state of affairs, driven by the shifting balance of power between factions within the British government and the political elite, gave rise to confusion. To those French interlocutors who dealt directly with the Foreign Secretary and his associates, it was clear that Sir Grey, as some of them quaintly called him, would stand by France in the event of a war, notwithstanding the official insistence on the non-binding character of the Entente. But to the Germans, who were not privy to these conversations, it looked very much as if Britain might stand aside from the Continental Coalition, especially if the Franco-Russian alliance took the initiative against Germany, rather than the other way around. The Agadir Crisis of 1911. The fluctuation of power across different points in the decision-making structures amplified the complexity and unpredictability of interactions in the European international system, especially in those moments of political crisis when two or more executives interacted with each other in an atmosphere of heightened pressure and threat. We can observe this effect with particular clarity in the quarrel that broke out between Germany and France over Morocco in the summer of 1911. The Franco-German-Moroccan Agreement of 1909 broke down, as we have seen, following a sequence of steps undertaken by the Quai d'Orsay, culminating in the dispatch of a large French force to the Sultanate in April 1911. On the 5th of June 1911, alarmed at the prospect of a unilateral French seizure of power in Morocco, the Spanish government deployed troops to occupy Larache and Kassar el-Kébir in northern and northwestern Morocco. A German intervention was now inevitable, and the gunboat Panther, an unimpressive craft that was 2 years overdue for scrapping, duly dropped anchor off the Moroccan coast on the 1st of July 1911. There is something very odd about the Agadir crisis. It was allowed to escalate to the point where it seemed that a Western European war was imminent, yet the positions advanced by the opposing parties were not irreconcilable, and eventually provided the basis for an enduring settlement. Why did the escalation happen? Part of the reason lay in the intransigence of the Quai d'Orsay. It was the Centrale that seized and held the initiative in the early phase of the crisis. The position of the permanent officials was strengthened by the fact that Foreign Minister Jean Crapi left office on the 27th of June, a few days before the Panther arrived off Agadir. His successor, Justin de Selve, a default candidate like Crapi, immediately fell under the thrall of the chef du cabinet at the French Foreign Ministry, Maurice Herbet. As chief of communications between 1907 and 1911, Herbet had built up an extensive network of newspaper contacts, and he worked hard during the Agadir crisis to discredit the very idea of talks with Germany. It was partly a consequence of the intransigence of Herbet and other powerful permanent officials that it was not until the end of July 1911 that the French ambassador in Berlin was even instructed to commence talks with Berlin about how Germany might be compensated for the consolidation of French exclusive dominion in Morocco. This conciliatory move was itself only possible because Ambassador Jules Cambon appealed from his Berlin posting over the head of his foreign minister to the energetic and outspoken premier, Joseph Caillou, who had taken office on the 27th of June, just before the crisis broke. The son of a finance minister, the celebrated Eugène Caillou, who had paid off the French indemnity to Germany so swiftly after 1870, Joseph Caillou was an economic liberal and fiscal moderniser who viewed foreign affairs with the pragmatic eyes of a businessman. He saw no reason why German commercial interests in Morocco should not be treated on exactly the same footing as those of other nationalities, and he was critical of the mercantilist style of economic strategy that had become a hallmark of European imperialism. The cabinet was split between Caillou, who favoured a conciliatory policy on Morocco, and Justin de Selve, who functioned as a mouthpiece for the hawks at the Quai d'Orsay. De Selve was under pressure from his ministry to send French cruisers to Agadir, a move that might have triggered a serious escalation. After Caillou vetoed this option, the hawks began to organize against him and Jules Cambon. Press releases were used to discredit the champions of conciliation. Caillou became so exasperated at Maurice Herbet's efforts to sabotage his policy that he summoned him to his office and told him, fitting the action to the words, "I will break you like this pencil." Caillou was eventually able to achieve an agreement with Germany, but only by conducting confidential and unofficial talks with Berlin, through the German embassy in Paris, through Jules Cambon in Berlin, and through the mediation of a businessman called Fondaire, that successfully circumvented the minister and his officials. The result was that by the beginning of August, Caillou had secretly accepted a compensation deal with Berlin, to which his foreign minister Justin de Selve remained adamantly opposed. This backstairs diplomacy helped the premier to bypass the Germanophobe hawks of the French foreign ministry, but it brought its own additional risks. In the first week of August 1911, a brief breakdown in communications led to an entirely unnecessary escalation, including threats to dispatch French and British warships to Agadir, even though Caillou and his German counterpart were at that point, in fact, both willing to compromise. Caillou blamed his mediator Fondaire for the misunderstanding, But there would have been no need for a go-between like Fondaire or for Caillot's backstairs dealing, had it not been for the fact that the officials of the ministry were conspiring to throw him out of office and wreck negotiations for an understanding with Germany. Inevitably, this also meant that Caillot was sometimes forced to backtrack on his commitments, because his ministerial colleagues refused to accept the assurances he had made to Berlin. And these complex manoeuvres heightened the uncertainty in Berlin about how French moves should be read. It was a matter of weighing contradictory trends against each other, as one junior German diplomat did when he reported that, despite the screaming in the press and the chauvinism of the army, Caillot's policy would probably prevail. As for German policy during the crisis, it was formulated not by Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg, and certainly not by the Kaiser, who was completely uninterested in Morocco, but by the energetic Swabian Imperial State Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Alfred von Kiedelen-Werther. Kiedelen had been involved in drawing up the Franco-German Agreement on Morocco of February 1909, and it was natural that he should play a leading role in formulating Germany's response to the French troop deployment. In a manner characteristic of the upper reaches of the German executive, the Foreign Secretary seized personal control of the Morocco policy thread, managing communications with Paris and keeping the Chancellor at arm's length from the developing crisis. Kiedelen had no interest in securing a German share of Morocco, but he was determined not to allow France unilaterally to impose exclusive control there. He hoped, by mirroring French moves with a sequence of incremental German gestures of protest, to secure an acknowledgement of German rights and some form of territorial compensation in the French Congo. He had good reason to believe that this objective could be secured without conflict, for in May 1911, Joseph Caillot, then finance minister, had assured German diplomats in Paris that France would be prepared if we, the Germans, recognized its vital interest in Morocco to make concessions to us elsewhere. After Caillot's accession to the office of Premier in June, therefore, Kiedelen assumed that this would be France's policy. He rejected plans to send two ships to Agadir. He believed that the Panther, which was not equipped to organize an effective landing and had no instructions to attempt one, would suffice for a symbolic demonstration. The subsequent evolution of the crisis revealed that Kiedelen had grossly misjudged the French response. He also seriously mismanaged the German domestic environment. Kiedelen's personal relations with Kaiser Wilhelm II were not especially cordial, and the Emperor was as sceptical of the administration's policy on North Africa in 1911 as he had been in 1905. In order to bolster himself against possible opposition from this quarter, Kiedelen marshalled the support of German ultra-nationalist politicians and publicists. But he was unable, once the press campaign got underway, to control its tone or content. As a consequence, a German policy that aimed consistently to keep the crisis below the threshold of armed confrontation unfolded against the background of thunderous nationalist press agitation that rang alarm bells in Paris and London. Banner headlines in the ultra-nationalist papers shrieking, "West Morocco to Germany," were grist to the mills of the hawks in Paris. They also worried the Kaiser, who issued such sharp criticisms of the Foreign Secretary's policy that on the 17th of July Kiedelen tendered his resignation. Only through Chancellor Bethmann's mediation was it possible to save the policy and keep Kiedelen in office. On the 4th of November 1911, a Franco-German treaty at last defined the terms of an agreement. Morocco became an exclusively French protectorate, German business interests were assured of respectful treatment, and parts of the French Congo were conceded to Germany. But the 1911 Moroccan crisis had exposed the perilous incoherence of French diplomacy. An internal disciplinary committee convened on the 18th of November 1911 to investigate the actions of Maurice Herbet revealed the elaborate machinations of the permanent officials in Paris. Caillot, too, was discredited. He and his cabinet were associated in the public eye with a treaty that many French nationalists thought had conceded too much to the Germans, which is remarkable, given that it conceded less than Delcasse had envisaged offering in exchange for Morocco in the late 1890s. Revelations of the Premier's secret negotiations with the Germans, acquired as decrypts by the Cabinet Noir and tactically leaked to the press by the Centrale, sealed his fate, and Caillou fell from office on the 21st of January 1912, having occupied the premiership for only 7 months. In Germany, too, the Treaty of November 1911 was denounced for granting the Germans too little. Kiederlin was partly to blame for this. There was a gaping discrepancy between what Germany could expect to achieve by challenging the French over Morocco and the glittering prizes, a German West Morocco, for example, held out to the public by the ultra-nationalist press, whose agitation Kiederlin had briefly and unwisely encouraged. By doing this, the Foreign Secretary contributed to the deepening alienation between the government and those who claimed to be its natural supporters on the far right. Yet this Faustian pact with the nationalist media had only been necessary because Kiederlin had no other means of ensuring that the sovereign would not compromise his own control of the policy-making process. Perhaps the most important consequence of German policy oscillation during the crisis was a growing tendency in Paris to misread German actions as driven by a policy of bluff. When he read the files of the Quai d'Orsay in the first months of 1912, the new incoming Premier and Foreign Minister, Raymond Poincaré, was struck by the alternation of toughness and concessions in German policy. "Whenever we have adopted a conciliatory approach to Germany," Poincaré observed, "she has abused it. On the other hand, on each occasion when we have shown firmness, she has yielded." From this, he drew the ominous conclusion that Germany understood only the language of force. Britain's involvement in the crisis, too, bore the imprint of deep divisions within the executive structure. The reaction of the Liberal cabinet in London was initially cautious, since it was felt that France was largely responsible for triggering the crisis and should be urged to give ground. On the 19th of July, the cabinet even authorized Grey to inform Paris that there were circumstances under which Britain might accept a German presence in Morocco. The French government angrily replied that British acquiescence on this point would amount to a breach in the Anglo-French Agreement of 1904. At the same time, the anti-Germans around Grey adopted a robustly pro-French position. Nicholson, Buchanan, Haldane, and Grey himself talked up the threat posed by Germany and revived the notion that what was at stake was the maintenance of the Entente. On the 19th of July, the Secretary of State for War, Richard Haldane, asked the Director of Military Operations, Sir Henry Wilson, to delay his departure for the continent so that he could spend a morning assessing prospective troop strengths in the event of a conflict on the Franco-German frontier. When Justin de Selve expressed surprise at the extent of German demands for compensation in the Congo, Sir Francis Bertie wrote to Grey from Paris of the excessive requirements of the Germans, which are known by them to be impossible of acceptance, and are intended to reconcile the French to the establishment of Germany on the Moroccan coast. This was a misreading of the German position, and it was calculated to strike fear into the British navalists, for whom the establishment of a German stronghold on the Atlantic would have been unacceptable. It was the prospect of a German Atlantic port that enabled Grey to secure cabinet approval for a private warning to the German ambassador on the 21st of July that if Germany meant to land at Agadir, Britain would be obliged to defend her interests there, by which Grey meant the deployment of British warships. On the same day, the Grey group raised the temperature yet further. On the evening of the 21st of July 1911, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, David Lloyd George, delivered a speech at the Mansion House issuing a sharp warning to Berlin. It was imperative, Lloyd George said, that Britain should maintain her place and her prestige among the great powers of the world. British power had more than once redeemed continental nations from overwhelming disaster and even from national extinction. If Britain were to be forced to choose between peace on the one hand and the surrender of her international preeminence on the other, then I say emphatically that peace at that price would be a humiliation intolerable for a great nation like ours to endure. In the days that followed, Grey stoked the fires of a naval panic in London, warning Lloyd George and Churchill that the British fleet was in danger of imminent attack, and informing Reginald McKenna, First Lord of the Admiralty, that the German fleet was mobilized and ready to strike. In reality, the High Seas fleet was scattered, and the Germans had no intention of concentrating it. The Mansion House speech was no spontaneous outburst. It was a gambit carefully planned by Grey, Asquith, and Lloyd George. Just as Caillou bypassed his Foreign Office in order to impose his own dovish agenda on the negotiations with Berlin, so the anti-Germans around Grey bypassed the dovish radicals in the Liberal cabinet in order to deliver a harsh and potentially provocative message to the Germans. Lloyd George had not cleared the sensitive passages of his speech with the cabinet, only with Prime Minister Asquith and Foreign Secretary Grey. The speech was all the more important for the fact that it signalled Lloyd George's defection from the camp of the dove radicals to that of the liberal imperialists. His words caused consternation in Berlin, where it was felt that the British government was needlessly disrupting the passage of Franco-German negotiations. Who is Lloyd George to lay down the law to Germany and to stop a quick Franco-German settlement? Arthur Zimmermann, Under-Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, asked the British ambassador in Berlin. Lloyd George's words also shocked those British cabinet ministers who had not signed up to Grey's programme. Viscount Morley, Secretary of State for India, denounced the speech, and Grey's subsequent defence of it in conversation with the German ambassador in London as an unwarranted and unfortunate provocation to Germany. The Lord Chancellor, Lord Loreburn, was appalled to find Britain so aggressively backing France in a dispute in which, as it seemed to Loreburn, Paris was by no means clear of blame. He entreated Grey to disavow the speech and to make it clear that Britain had no intention of interfering in the negotiations between France and Germany. The Grey group prevailed. At a meeting of the Committee of Imperial Defence, convened on the 23rd of August 1911, it was agreed that should a Franco-German war break out, Britain would mount a rapid continental intervention, including the transshipment of a British expeditionary force. Asquith, Grey, Haldane, Lloyd George, and the service chiefs were present, but key radicals, including Morley, Crewe, Harcourt, and Esher, were either not informed or not invited. The weeks that followed were filled, to the horror of the radicals, with enthusiastic planning for war. Even Asquith recoiled from the extensive military conversations designed to coordinate mobilization plans and strategy with the French in September 1911, but Grey refused to have them stopped. To a greater extent than either of the two original quarrelling parties, Britain was willing to consider the possibility of a drastic escalation. While the French had made no war preparations, even at the height of the crisis, Bethmann remarked in a letter to the German ambassador in London, "Britain seems to have been ready to strike every day." The Austrian foreign minister, Count Ehrenthal, came to a similar conclusion, noting on the 3rd of August that England had for a moment seemed ready to use the Moroccan quarrel as a pretext for a full-on reckoning with its German rival. The contrast with Russia's relatively reserved and conciliatory position was particularly striking. Only after this British reaction did Vienna abandon the policy of neutrality it had hitherto adopted on the Morocco question. The battle between the hawks and the doves was not yet over. Just as the officials of the French Foreign Ministry wrought their revenge upon Caillou and the hapless Justin de Selves, toppling them from office in January 1912, so, in Britain, the radical liberal sceptics renewed their assault on the policy pursued by Grey. Among the ministers, there were many who had never appreciated the depth of Grey's commitments to France before Agadir. In December 1911, there was a backbench revolt against Grey. Part of the ill-feeling against him arose from a frustration at the secretiveness of his tactics. Why had no one been told about the undertakings the government was supposedly making on behalf of the British people? Arthur Ponsonby and Noel Buxton, both prominent liberal anti-Grey activists, demanded that a committee be formed to improve Anglo-German relations. The backlash against the Foreign Secretary swept through virtually the entire liberal press. But whereas the diehards in Paris did succeed in discrediting both Caillaux and his conciliatory approach, the pro-German lobby in Britain failed to dislodge Grey or his policy. There were three reasons for this. The first was that British ministers were inherently less vulnerable to this kind of campaigning, thanks to the robust partisan structure of British parliamentary politics. Then there was the fact that if Grey's policy were comprehensively disavowed, he himself might resign, taking Lloyd George, Haldane, and possibly Churchill with him. This would be the end of the Liberals in government, a sobering thought for the Liberal non-interventionists. No less important was the support of the parliamentary Conservatives for Grey's policy of military entente with France. One of the things that helped the Foreign Secretary to weather the storms of the Agadir crisis was the secret assurance of support from Arthur Balfour, leader of the Conservative Party until November 1911. This dependence on the parliamentary opposition would prove something of a liability in the summer of 1914, when a looming crisis over Ireland raised questions about the continuation of Conservative support. But if the essentials of Grey's Ententist policy remained in place, the fact that he had to defend his position against such vociferous and influential domestic opposition nonetheless prevented him from articulating his commitments as unequivocally as he might have wished. After Agadir, Grey had to walk a tightrope between French demands that he make a clearer commitment and the insistence of the non-interventionists in cabinet, who were, after all, still in the majority, that he do no such thing. In two cabinet resolutions of November 1911, 15 of his fellow cabinet ministers called Grey to order, demanding that he desist from sponsoring high-level military discussions between Britain and France without their prior knowledge and approval. In January 1912, there was talk among the non-interventionists, led by Loreburn, of agreeing a cabinet statement to the effect that Britain was not under any obligation, direct or indirect, express or implied, to support France against Germany by force of arms. Grey and his people were spared this blow only by Loreburn's illness and retirement. The need to balance such concerted opposition from inside his government with a policy focused on maintaining the Entente as a security device produced a baffling ambiguity in British diplomatic signalling. On the one hand, British military commanders had always been accorded a certain discretion in their dealings with their French colleagues. Their assurances of British military support in the event of a conflict with Germany helped to harden the French position. These initiatives were not sanctioned by cabinet, let alone by the British Parliament. During the Agadir crisis of 1911, the new DMO, Major General Henry Wilson, was sent to Paris for discussions with the French General Staff aimed at agreeing a schedule for an Anglo-French joint mobilization against Germany. The resulting Wilson-Dubai Memorandum of the 21st of July 1911, General Auguste Dubai was at that time the French General Staff Chief, stipulated that by day 15 of mobilization, 6 British infantry divisions, 1 cavalry division and 2 mounted brigades, encompassing 150,000 men and 67,000 horses, would be deployed on the French left flank. The decision in the early months of 1912 to neutralize German naval expansion by coordinating Anglo-French naval strategy strengthened the presumption that something like a defensive alliance was coming into existence. On the other hand, the famous Grey-Cambon letters of the 22nd to 23rd of November 1912 extorted, as Morley later put it, from Grey by his non-interventionist opponents, made it clear that the Entente was anything but an alliance, for they asserted the freedom of both partners to act independently, even if one of the parties were to be attacked by a third power. Was there an obligation to support France, or was there not? It was all very well for Grey to declare in public that these were mere contingency plans with no binding force. In private, the Foreign Secretary acknowledged that he viewed the Anglo-French military conversations as committing us to cooperate with France, so long as her actions were non-provocative and reasonable. When the permanent Under-Secretary for Foreign Affairs, Sir Arthur Nicholson, insisted to Grey at the beginning of August 1914 that "You have over and over again promised Monsieur Cambon that if Germany was the aggressor, you would stand by France," Grey merely replied, "Yes, but he has nothing in writing." Anglo-French diplomacy thus came to be marked at the highest level, on the British side, by a kind of doublethink. It was understood that Grey must tailor his public statements and even his official communications to the expectations of the non-interventionists in cabinet and among the broader public. Yet when Paul Cambon listened to his anti-German friends in London, or to Bertie in Paris, he heard what he wanted to hear. This was a difficult arrangement for the French to live with, to say the least. As the July crisis of 1914 reached its climax, it would cost the decision-makers in Paris, the French ambassador in London, and indeed Grey himself, a few moments of high anxiety. More importantly, uncertainty about the British commitment forced French strategists to compensate in the East for their weaknesses in the West by committing ever more strongly to militarizing the alliance with Russia. The French government, Baron Guillaume, the Belgian minister in Paris, noted in the spring of 1913, was obliged to tighten more and more its alliance with Russia, because it is aware that Britain's friendship for it is less and less solid and effective. For Germany, too, the irresolution of British policy was a source of confusion and vexation. On the one hand, Grey was obliged to maintain the appearance of an open door to Berlin in order to placate the non-interventionists. Yet he also felt obliged from time to time to administer harsh warnings to the Germans, lest they come to the conclusion that France had been comprehensively abandoned and could be attacked without fear of a British response. The result of this system of mixed messaging, a consequence of the mutability of power relations within the European executives, was a perennial uncertainty about British intentions that would unsettle the policymakers in Berlin throughout the July crisis. Soldiers and civilians. "The situation in Europe is extraordinary," Colonel Edward House reported to American President Woodrow Wilson after a trip to Europe in May 1914. "It is militarism run stark mad." House's views may have been shaped in part by a personal experience. He was a political colonel of the American type. He had been appointed to that rank in the Texas militia in return for political services there. But when Colonel House visited Berlin, the Germans took him to be a military man and always sat him with the generals at dinner. His views on the prevalence of militarism may have owed something to this unfortunate misunderstanding. Be that as it may, there is no doubt that, viewed from across the Atlantic, pre-war Europe presented a curious spectacle. Senior statesmen, emperors, and kings attended public occasions, wearing military uniform. Elaborate military reviews were an integral part of the public ceremonial of power. Immense, illuminated naval displays drew huge crowds and filled the pages of the illustrated journals. Conscript armies grew in size until they became male microcosms of the nation. The cult of military display entered the public and the private life of even the smallest communities. In what ways did this militarism shape the decisions that led Europe to war in 1914? Did the roots of the July crisis lie, as some historians have argued, in an abdication of responsibility by civilian politicians and a usurpation of political power by the generals? There was, without doubt, a struggle between the soldiers and the civilians within the pre-war executives. It was a struggle for money. Defense expenditure accounted for a substantial share of government spending. Military commanders keen to improve equipment, training, and infrastructure had to contend, as they do today, with civilian politicians for access to government resources. Conversely, ministers of finance and their political allies fought to impose restraint in the name of fiscal rigor or domestic consolidation. Who prevailed in these contests depended on the structure of the institutional environment and the prevailing domestic and international political constellation. Until 1908, the chaotic structure of the Russian military command made it difficult for the generals to lobby government effectively. But the balance began to shift from 1908, when reforms to the military administration created a more concentrated executive structure, establishing the Minister of War as the preeminent defense official, with the exclusive right to report to the Tsar on military matters. From 1909, a rivalry of epic bitterness evolved between the new war minister, Vladimir Sukhomlinov, who was still in post in July 1914, and the strong-willed conservative finance minister, Vladimir Kakovtsev. Backed by the powerful premier, Pyotr Stolypin, Kakovtsev, a champion of fiscal responsibility and domestic economic development, routinely blocked or curtailed Sukhomlinov's draft budgets. Professional friction swiftly deepened into lively personal hatred. Sukhomlinov thought Kakovtsev narrow, verbose, and self-seeking. Kakovtsev accused the Minister of War, with more justice, of incompetence, irresponsibility, and corruption. Kakovtsev's German equivalent was Adolf Wermuth, Treasury Minister in 1909-11, who, with the support of Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, worked hard to rebalance the Reich budget and cut public debt. Wermuth was critical of overspending under Tirpitz and often complained of the naval secretary's irresponsibility, just as Kakovtsev complained of Sukhomlinov's profligate handling of military funding. The Treasury minister's motto was, "No expenditures without revenues." There was also perennial tension between the chief of staff and the Minister of War, since the former's demands for increased funding were often rejected or opposed by the latter. A recent study has even suggested that the famous memorandum of 1905, in which the chief of the general staff, Alfred von Schlieffen, sketched the outlines of a massive westward offensive, was not a war plan as such, but a plea for more government money. Among other things, Schlieffen's sketch envisaged the deployment of 81 divisions, more than the German army when mobilized actually possessed at the time. The question of military finance was complicated in Germany by the fact that the federal constitution assigned direct taxation revenues to the member states rather than to the Reich government. The devolved structure of the German Empire placed a fiscal limit on Reich defense expenditure that had no direct counterpart in Britain, France, or Russia. Nevertheless, the conflict over resources was muted in Germany by the fact that military budgets were submitted to the Parliament only at five-yearly intervals, a system known as the Quinquennat. Because senior military figures valued the Quinquennat as a means of protecting the army from constant parliamentary interference, they were reluctant to jeopardize it by requesting large extra-budgetary credits. This system worked as a powerful incentive for self-restraint. As the Prussian Minister of War, Karl von Einem, observed in June 1906, the Quinquennat was a cumbersome arrangement, but it was useful nonetheless, because the savage and persistent agitation against the existence of the army, which arises with every military expansion, would only become all the more dangerous if it were a yearly occurrence. Even in 1911, when the Quinquennat came up for renewal, and Chief of Staff Moltke and War Minister Heringen joined forces in pressing for substantial growth, the opposition of Treasury Minister Wermuth and Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg ensured that the resulting increase in the strength of the peacetime army was very modest, 10,000 men. We can discern analogous tensions in every European executive. In Britain, the Liberals campaigned, and won an absolute majority, in 1906, on the promise to cut back the vast military expenditure of the Boer War years under the slogan "Peace, Retrenchment, and Reform." Budgetary constraints were a significant factor in the decision to seek an understanding with France and Russia. One consequence was that, while British naval budgets continued to soar, British naval spending was three times the German figure in 1904, and still more than double in 1913. Army expenditure remained static throughout the pre-war years, forcing War Minister Haldane to focus on efficiency savings and reorganization rather than expansion. In Austria-Hungary, the tumultuous domestic politics of dualism virtually paralyzed the monarchy's military development after the turn of the century, as autonomist groups within the Hungarian parliament fought to starve the monarchy's joint army of Hungarian tax revenues and recruits. In this environment, proposals for increased military allocations were worn down in endless legislative feuding, and the Habsburg military languished in a condition, as the Austrian staff chief put it, of persistent stagnation. This was one reason why, as late as 1912, Austria-Hungary spent only 2.6% of its net national product on defence, a smaller proportion than any other European power, and certainly far below what its economy could afford. The figures for Russia, France, and Germany in that year were 4.5, 4.0, and 3.8%, respectively. In France, the Dreyfus Affair of the 1890s had destroyed the civil-military consensus of the Third Republic and placed the senior echelons of the army, viewed as a bastion of clerical and reactionary attitudes, under a cloud of public suspicion, especially in the eyes of the republican and anti-clerical left. In the wake of the scandal, three successive radical governments pursued a program of aggressive republicanizing military reform, especially under Prime Ministers Émile Combes, 1903-5, and Georges Clemenceau, 1906-9. Government control over the army was tightened. The civilian-minded Ministry of War grew stronger vis-à-vis the regular army commanders, and the period of service was reduced in March 1905, against the advice of the military experts, from 3 years to two, with a view to transforming the politically suspect Praetorian Guard of the Dreyfus years into a citizen army of civilian reservists for national defence in wartime. Only in the last pre-war years did the tide begin to turn in favour of the French military. In France, as earlier in Russia, the army leadership was streamlined in 1911, and the chief of the general staff, Joseph Joffre, was designated as the official responsible for military planning in peacetime and the command of the main army at war. The long and painful story of the struggle to secure increased funds continued, but in 1912-14, the pro-military attitude of the Poincaré government and then of the Poincaré presidency, reinforced by complex realignments in French politics and opinion, created an environment more conducive to rearmament. By 1913, it was politically feasible to press for a return to a three-year training regime, albeit over the protests of Finance Minister Louis-Lucien Clotz, who argued that the reinforcement of border fortifications would be cheaper and more effective. In Germany, too, the souring of the mood after Agadir encouraged Minister of War Josias von Heringen and Chief of Staff Helmut von Moltke to press harder for army growth. From his position in the Reich Treasury Office, Adolf Wermuth fought a robust rearguard action against higher expenditures, but resigned in March 1912, after it became clear that his policy no longer enjoyed broad governmental support. The fiscal rigorism of the Wermuth era was renounced, and the exponents of military expenditure gradually gained the upper hand over their naval rivals. After a long period of relative stagnation, the Army Bill of the 3rd of July 1913 took German military expenditure to unprecedented heights. In Russia, Vladimir Kakovtsev, who remained finance minister and succeeded Pyotr Stolypin as premier after the latter's assassination, found it harder and harder to fight off the relentless lobbying and backstairs intrigues of War Minister Sokomlinov. The feud between the two men came to a head at an important ministerial meeting in the spring of 1913, when Sokomlinov ambushed the premier with a major budgetary proposal on which everyone at the table had been briefed, except Kakovtsev himself. The support of the sovereign was crucial to this shift in the balance of power. "In your conflicts with Sukhomlinov, you are always right," Nicholas II told Kakovtsev in October 1912. "But I want you to understand my attitude. I have been supporting Sukhomlinov, not because I have no confidence in you, but because I cannot refuse to agree to military appropriations." Did this massive transfer of resources entail a transfer of power, or at least of political influence? An answer to this question has to take account of the diverse conditions prevailing in the various states. The country where we encounter the firmest regime of civilian control is, without doubt, France. In December 1911, when Joffre outlined his new strategic plan, focused on a massive offensive deployment across the Franco-German border, the radical Prime Minister, Joseph Caillou, curtly informed the staff chief that decision-making was ultimately the responsibility of the civilian authorities. The task of the CGS, Caillou frequently pointed out, was merely to advise his political masters on the matters that fell within his expertise. The switch to increased military expenditure and the decision to invest in Joffre's offensive deployment in 1912-14 emanated not from the military, but from the politicians, under the leadership of the hawkish but, in constitutional terms, emphatically civilian Raymond Poincaré. The situation in Russia was quite different. Here, the presence of the Tsar as the focal point of the autocratic system made it possible for individual ministers to carve out a certain relative autonomy. War Minister Vladimir Sukhomlinov is a characteristic example. At the time of his appointment in 1909, a struggle was raging in St. Petersburg over parliamentary control of the army. An influential group of deputies was attempting to assert the Duma's right of oversight over defense policy. Sukhomlinov was brought in to see off the Duma, prevent the infiltration of civilian attitudes into military decision-making, and protect the Tsar's prerogative, a role that earned him the hatred of public opinion, but assured him strong support from the throne. This backing from the sovereign enabled the war minister to formulate a security policy dramatically at variance with official Russian commitments to the alliance with France. Rather than meeting French demands for a swift offensive strike against Germany in the first phase of mobilization, Sukhomlinov's reorganization of 1910 shifted the focus of Russian deployments away from the western border zones in the Polish salient to locations in the Russian interior. The aim was to achieve a better balance between unit strengths and population density, and to create a force that could be deployed, if necessary, to an eastern theater of operations. The extreme west was to be abandoned to the enemy in the first phase of hostilities, pending a massive combined counteroffensive by the Russian armies. It does not seem that any effort was made to square this innovation with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. French military experts were initially horrified at the new plan, which they saw as depriving the Franco-Russian alliance of the military initiative against Germany. The Russians did ultimately address these French concerns, but it is remarkable nonetheless that Sukhomlinov possessed sufficient independence to devise and implement a policy that appeared to run against the grain of the alliance with France, the centerpiece of Russian foreign policy. Armed with the support of the Tsar, Sukhomlinov was also able to undermine the authority of Prime Minister Kakovtsev, not just by challenging him over military budgeting, but also by building a hostile bloc in the Council of Ministers. And this, in turn, furnished him with a platform from which he could expound his views on Russia's security situation. In a series of key meetings in the fourth week of November 1912, Sukhomlinov expounded the view that war was inevitable, and it would be more profitable for us to begin it as soon as possible. A war, he argued, would bring Russia nothing but good. These bizarre and deluded claims astonished the cautious Kakovtsev. But Sukhomlinov was able to do this only because he had the support of other civilian ministers, Rukov, Maklakov, Szczeglowitow, and, most importantly, the powerful A.V. Krivoshein, Minister of Agriculture and a confidant of the Tsar. In the last months of 1912, a war party emerged within the Council of Ministers, led by Sukhumlinov and Krivoshein. In Germany, too, the Praetorian character of the system assured the military a certain freedom of manoeuvre. Key figures, such as the chief of staff, could clearly acquire intermittent leverage on decision-making, especially at moments of heightened tension. Establishing what military commanders said is easy enough. Ascertaining the weight of their counsels in government decision-making is much less straightforward, especially in an environment where the absence of a collegial decision-making organ like the Russian Council of Ministers removed the need for open conflict between military and civilian office holders. One way of understanding the interaction between military and civilian policy-making is to examine the relationship between the official diplomatic apparatus of ambassadors, ministers, and legation secretaries, and the parallel network, overseen by the General Staff and the Admiralty, of the military and naval attachés, whose perspective on events sometimes diverged from that of the official diplomatic networks. To take just one example, in October 1911, Wilhelm Widenmann, the German naval attaché in London, sent an alarming report to Berlin. British naval officers, Widenmann wrote, were now openly admitting that England had mobilized its entire fleet during the summer months of the Agadir crisis. England, it seemed, had merely been waiting for a signal from France to fall upon Germany. To make matters worse, the new First Sea Lord was the unscrupulous, ambitious, and unreliable demagogue Winston Churchill. Germany must therefore steel itself for the possibility of an unprovoked attack, in the manner of the British annihilation of the Danish fleet at Copenhagen in 1807. Further naval rearmament was essential, for only one thing impresses in England: a firm goal and the indomitable will to accomplish it. These dispatches were passed to Wilhelm II, who covered them in delighted annotations. Correct, correct, excellent, and so on. There was nothing especially remarkable in any of this. Widenmann was reacting in part to what he had observed in London, but his underlying purpose was to prevent the General Staff back in Berlin from using the Agadir crisis to challenge the financial preeminence of the Navy. The significance of the Widenmann reports lay less in their content or the Kaiser's reactions than in the response they elicited from the Chancellor and the Foreign Secretary. Irritated by this para-diplomatic panic-mongering, Bethmann-Hollweg requested the German ambassador in London, Count Metternich, to file a counter-dispatch refuting Widenmann's arguments. Metternich responded with a report that nuanced Widenmann's claims. While it was true that all England had been prepared for war in the summer of 1911, this did not imply a readiness for aggressive action. To be sure, there were many younger naval officers to whom a war would not be unwelcome, but this was an attitude common to the military functionaries of other countries. In any case, Metternich observed, and here was the sting, in England such questions were decided not by army or naval officers, nor by ministers of war, nor by the First Sea Lord, but rather by a cabinet composed of responsible ministers. Over here, Metternich announced, fleet and army are regarded as the most important instruments of policy, as means to an end, but not as determinants of the course of policy. In any case, the English were now keen to put the tensions of the summer behind them. Instead of putting all of its eggs in the armaments basket, therefore, the German government should seek an improvement in its relations with London. This time the Kaiser was less happy. Wrong. Rubbish. Unbelievable hogwash. Scaredy-cat, screamed the scribbles on the margins of the document. I don't agree with the judgment of the ambassador. The naval attaché is right. The odd thing about this pair of conflicting dispatches is that both of them went on to shape policy. The Kaiser used the Widenmann report as a pretext for demanding a further naval law, while Bethmann persisted with the policy of détente recommended by Metternich. In Germany, as one senior commander later observed, the Kaiser made one policy, the Chancellor another, and the General Staff came up with its own answers. It looks, at first glance, as if we can draw a line between democratic, parliamentary Britain and France on the one hand, where civilian decision-makers called the shots, and the more authoritarian constitutions of Russia, Austria, and Germany, where, despite variations in the degree of parliamentarization, military personnel could compete with their civilian colleagues on an equal or superior footing for political influence, thanks to their privileged access to the sovereign. But the reality was more complex than this dichotomy would allow. In France, the restructuring of the military after 1911 produced an extraordinary concentration of authority in the hands of Chief of Staff Joffre, to the extent that he wielded greater power over the armed forces than his aristocratic, militarist German counterpart, Helmut von Moltke. What is more, the new French measures secured for the army almost complete autonomy within the state, though this autonomy depended, unlike that of the German army, upon the cooperation and support of the relevant civilian ministers. In Britain, too, the deepening of the Entente with France was driven by military rather than civilian negotiations and agreements. We have already seen how eagerly key military figures in Britain proffered support to France during the first Moroccan crisis in 1905-6. And it is far from clear that the leading British military commanders saw themselves as compliant servants of their political masters. Wilson was not simply acting on instructions. He had his own views on Britain's military role in a future continental war, and consistently pressed for a military confrontation. Like his continental colleagues, Wilson despised civilian politicians, believing them entirely incapable of understanding military affairs. Sir Edward Grey, he wrote in his diary, was an ignorant, vain, and weak man, quite unfit to be the foreign minister of any country larger than Portugal. As for the rest of the Liberal cabinet, they were no more than dirty, ignorant curs. The whole idea of civilian government of the army was vicious in theory and hopeless in practice. Conservative in his politics, Wilson intrigued energetically against a liberal political leadership he despised, siphoning information from the Foreign Office through his close associate, permanent Undersecretary Sir Arthur Nicholson, and passing it to his allies in the Conservative Party. In Major General Henry Wilson, Britain possessed its own version of Austria-Hungary's Konrad and Serbia's Apis. The significance of the military discussions with France lay not just in the pressure they exerted on the civilian leadership, but also in the fact that they seemed, by virtue of their very existence, to imply a moral obligation to fight with France in the event of a war with Germany. The militarization of the Entente thus exposed the widening discrepancy between British military planning and an official diplomatic stance for which the commitments associated with the term alliance were still anathema. Something analogous took place in the context of the French alliance with Russia. The efforts of the French military commanders to undo the effects of Sukhomlinov's 1910 deployment plan led to a deepening interdependence of military planning in the two Allied states, a process managed by the military but sanctioned by the civilian leadership. But even as the civilians licensed this process, they could not prevent it from shifting the parameters within which political decisions could be made. When the French insisted at the annual Franco-Russian Joint General Staff meetings that the Russians spend vast amounts of borrowed money to upgrade their westward strategic railways, the effect was to push the balance of power in St. Petersburg away from Kokovtsev towards his adversaries in the Russian military command. Kokovtsev was probably right when he accused the military command of exploiting inter-service ties within the alliance in order to strengthen their own leverage within the Russian political system. Conversely, the demands of the Russians on their French allies had potentially far-reaching consequences for French domestic politics. In 1914, when the Russians warned that any reduction in the period of national military service would undermine the value of France as an ally, they locked the country's leading statesmen into supporting a measure, the recently adopted three-year law, which was controversial with the French electorate. Even the most technical details of operational planning could provide gunpowder for political explosions. In France, a small group of key policymakers went to great pains to conceal the extent and nature of the strategic commitments of the alliance from those, mainly radicals and radical socialists, who might object on political grounds. The need for discretion became especially acute in early 1914, when Poincaré cooperated with the military in concealing the essentially offensive character of French strategic planning from a cabinet, a chamber, and a public increasingly committed to a défensiste approach. So secretive was Poincaré in his handling of these issues that he and Joffre even withheld the details of the new French deployment plans from the Minister of War, Adolphe Messimy. By the spring of 1914, the French commitment to a coordinated Franco-Russian military strategy had become a potentially disruptive force in politics, because it obliged France to hold fast to a form of military planning and preparation whose public legitimacy was in question. How long Poincaré could have continued this balancing act, we shall never know, because the outbreak of war in the summer of 1914 made the question obsolete. We can thus speak of two reciprocal processes, one in which a generous measure of initiative was ceded to a constitutionally subordinate military leadership, and another in which a Praetorian military, enjoying relative independence in constitutional terms, was contained, steered, or deflected by the statesman. Moltke's demands for preventive war were blocked by the Kaiser and by the civilian leaders, just as Conrad's were by the Emperor, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and Leopold von Berchtold. Kakovtsev was, for a time at least, strikingly successful in blocking the war minister's more ambitious initiatives. At the end of 1913, when Sukhomlinov tried to have Kakovtsev, as Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, excluded entirely from deliberations on military budgeting, the Council of Ministers recognized that the imperious war minister had gone too far and turned down the request. In Russia, Germany, and Austria, Britain, and France, military policy remained ultimately subordinate to the political and strategic objectives of the civilian leaderships. Nevertheless, unanswered questions about the balance of power between civilian and military factions and their respective influence on decision-making continued to befog relations between the great power executives. The European powers all assumed the existence of a hawkish military faction within each prospective opponent's government and worked hard to establish how much influence it wielded. In a conversation with Count Portales, the German ambassador in St. Petersburg at the beginning of February 1913, when Austro-Russian tensions over the Balkans were riding high, Foreign Minister Sazonov acknowledged that the Austro-Hungarian foreign minister, whom he remembered from his St. Petersburg days, was a man of peaceable intentions and outlook. But was he strong enough to resist the pressure from the chief of the general staff, General Konrad von Herzendorf, whose belligerent schemes were well known to Russian military intelligence? And even if Berchtold was still, for the moment, in control, might not power slip into the hands of the military as the dual monarchy grew weaker and looked for increasingly radical solutions? There was an element of projection in these speculations. Sazonov, who observed at first hand the power struggle between Sukhomlinov and Kakovtsev, and had recently seen the staff chief push Russia to the brink of war with Austria-Hungary, knew better than most how labile the relationship between military and civilian decision-makers could be. In a subtle analysis of the mood in St. Petersburg in March 1914, Portales discerned a kind of equilibrium between belligerent and pacific elements. Just as there are no personalities of whom one can say that they have both the desire and the influence to plunge Russia into a military adventure, so we lack men whose position and influence are strong enough to awaken confidence that they will be able to steer Russia on a peaceful course over a period of years. Kakovtsev's analysis of the same problem was less sanguine. It seemed to him that the Tsar spent more and more of his time in the company of military circles, whose simplistic views were gathering more and more force. The intrinsic difficulty of interpreting such relationships from an external vantage point was heightened by the fact that civilian politicians were not averse to exploiting, or even inventing, the existence of a war party to lend weight to their own arguments. Thus, during the Haldane mission of 1912, the Germans encouraged the British to believe that the Berlin government was split between a dove and a hawk faction, and that British concessions would strengthen Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg against belligerent elements in Berlin. They adopted the same tactic in May 1914, arguing, through a series of inspired press articles, that the continuation of Anglo-Russian naval talks would merely strengthen the hand of the militarists against the moderate civilian leadership. Here, as in other areas of intergovernmental communication, the mutability of civil-military relations within the respective systems was amplified by misperceptions and misrepresentations. The press and public opinion. Most of the conflicts the world has seen in the past 10 decades, the German Chancellor Bernhard von Bülow declared before the German Parliament in March 1909, have not been called forth by princely ambition or ministerial conspiracy, but through the passionate agitation of public opinion, which, through the press and Parliament, has swept along the executive. Was there any truth in Bülow's claim? Did the power to shape foreign policy lie beyond the chancelleries and ministries in the world of the lobby groups and political print? One thing is beyond doubt. The last decades before the outbreak of the war saw a dramatic expansion of the political public sphere and broader public discussion of issues linked to international relations. In Germany, an array of nationalist pressure groups emerged, dedicated to channeling popular sentiment and lobbying government. The consequence was a transformation in the substance and style of political critique, which became more demagogic and more diffuse and extreme in its objectives, so that governments often found themselves on the defensive, parrying charges that they had not been assertive enough in the pursuit of national aims. In Italy, too, we can discern the beginnings of a more assertive and demanding political public. Under the influence of the ultra-nationalist Enrico Corradini and the demagogue Giovanni Papini, Italy's first nationalist party, the Associazione Nazionalista Italiana, was founded in 1910 through its parliamentary deputies and its newspaper, L'Idea Nazionale. It demanded the immediate repatriation of the Italian-populated territories along the Adriatic coast of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and was prepared to endorse war if no other means sufficed. By 1911, even more moderate papers, such as La Tribuna of Rome and La Stampa of Turin, were employing nationalist journalists. Here, even more than in Germany, there was ample potential for friction with a government obliged to balance conflicting priorities. In Russia, too, the last decades of the 19th century saw the emergence of a mass press. By 1913, the Ruskoye Slovo, Moscow's best-selling daily paper, was selling up to 800,000 copies per day. Although censorship was still operating, the authorities permitted fairly free discussion of foreign affairs, as long as they did not directly criticize the Tsar or his ministers, and many of the most important dailies engaged retired diplomats to write on foreign policy. In the aftermath of the Bosnian crisis, moreover, Russian public opinion grew more assertive, especially on Balkan issues, and more anti-governmental. In Britain, too, a burgeoning mass press fed its readers on a rich diet of jingoism, xenophobia, security scares, and war fever. During the Boer War, the Daily Mail sold 1 million copies per day. In 1907, it was still averaging between 850,000 and 900,000. Monarchs, ministers, and senior officials thus had good reason to take the press seriously. In parliamentary systems, positive publicity might be expected to translate into votes, while negative coverage supplied grist for the mills of the opposition. In more authoritarian systems, public support was an indispensable ersatz for democratic legitimacy. Some monarchs and statesmen were positively obsessive about the press and spent hours each day poring through cuttings. Wilhelm II was an extreme case, but his sensitivity to public criticism was not in itself unusual. If we lose the confidence of public opinion in our foreign policy, Tsar Alexander III had told Foreign Minister Lambsdorff, then all is lost. It is hard to find anyone in the executives of early 20th century Europe who did not acknowledge the importance of the press for the making of foreign policy. But were they swept along by it? An ambivalence underlay the preoccupation with published opinion. On the one hand, ministers, officials, and monarchs believed in and sometimes even feared the press as a mirror and channel for public sentiments and attitudes. All the foreign ministers knew what it was like to be exposed to a hostile domestic press campaign over which they had no control. Grey was the butt of the liberal press in 1911. Kilian Wächter was attacked in the nationalist papers after the Agadir crisis. The Kaiser was ridiculed for many reasons, among them for his supposedly timid and irresolute view of foreign policy. French politicians suspected of softness towards Germany could be hounded, like Joseph Caillou, from office. In January 1914, Sazonov and his ministry were denounced for pusillanimity by the Russian nationalist press. Fear of negative publicity was one reason for the secretiveness of so many of the foreign ministries. As Charles Harding observed in a letter to Nicholson, then British ambassador in St. Petersburg in 1908, Edward Grey's policy of rapprochement with Russia was difficult to sell to the British public. "We have had to suppress the truth and resort to subterfuge at times to meet hostile public opinion." In St. Petersburg, the memory of the publicity storm that had ruined Izvolsky remained fresh throughout the pre-war years. Most policymakers took an intelligent and differentiated view of the press. They saw that it was volatile, subject to short-term agitations and frenzies that quickly subsided. They understood that public sentiment was driven by contrary impulses, that the demands it made on government were seldom realistic. They saw, to paraphrase Theodore Roosevelt, that public opinion usually combined the unbridled tongue with the unready hand. Public opinion was frenetic and panic-prone, but it was also highly mutable. Witness the way in which the established Anglophobia of the French press melted away during Edward VII's visit to Paris in 1903, as the king drove with his entourage from the Porte Dauphine railway station down the Champs-Élysées. There were shouts of "Vive Fashoda," "Vive les Bourgs," and "Vive Jeanne d'Arc," not to mention hostile headlines and insulting caricatures. Yet, within a few days, the king won over his hosts with endearing speeches and charming remarks that were quickly taken up by the main newspapers. In Serbia, the wave of national outrage stirred by Austria's interdiction of the customs union with Bulgaria in 1906 soon died away as Serbian citizens woke up to the fact that the terms of the commercial treaty on offer from Austria-Hungary were in fact better for Serbian consumers than membership of the Union with Sofia. There were sharp fluctuations in public sentiment in Germany during the Agadir crisis of 1911. At the beginning of September, a peace demonstration in Berlin attracted 100,000 people, yet, only a few weeks later, the mood was less emollient, as reflected in the decision of the Social Democratic Party's Jena Congress to reject calls for a general strike in the event of war. As late as the spring and summer of 1914, the French envoy in Belgrade noted sharp fluctuations in Serbian press coverage of relations with Austria-Hungary. Whereas there had been energetic campaigns against Vienna in March and April, the first week of June brought an unexpected mood of détente and conciliation on both sides of the Austro-Serbian border. As for those aggressive ultra-nationalist organizations whose voices could be heard in all the European capitals, most of them represented small, extremist constituencies. It was a striking feature of the most belligerent ultra-nationalist lobbies that their leaderships were undermined by constant infighting and schisms. The Pan-German League was riven by factional strife. Even the much larger and more moderate Naval League suffered in the years 1905-8 from an internal civil war between pro-governmental and oppositional groups. The Union of the Russian People, a chauvinist, anti-Semitic, ultra-nationalist organization founded in August 1906, with some 900 offices across the cities and towns of Russia, collapsed in 1908-9 after severe infighting into an array of smaller and mutually hostile groups. It remained unclear how the public opinion within articulate elites, with direct access to the press, related to the attitudes prevailing among the masses of the population. War scares and jingo